Chapter 13. When the Laws Against the Laws. Violent crime, including homicides, rose precipitously starting in 1965. By 1980, violent crime rates overall were 250% higher than they had been 20 years earlier, while property crime rates were 200% higher. Following a brief lull in the early 80s, violent crime rose again in 1984 and peaked in 1991 at over 400% of the 1960 level, which many scholars attribute to the rise of crack cocaine and battles between dealers for turf. By the early 1990s, violent crime in the United States had never been worse, while property crime remained almost as high as it had been in 1980. Then, between 1993 and 2018, homicides declined 47%, and violent crime overall declined 49% in U.S. cities. While the rise of crack increased violence, historians believe that previously high rates of violence in inner-city African-American neighborhoods attracted the drug dealing more than the drug dealing introduced violence. Evidence for this comes from the fact that the black homicide rate declined 20% from 1970, when Nixon declared a war on drugs, to 1990, the height of crack-related violence. The relationship between drug dealing and violence suggests that many of those incarcerated on drug charges during the more violent 1980s and 1990s would have been imprisoned regardless of the war on drugs. In his 1999 book, Why They Kill, The Discoveries of a Maverick Criminologist, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Richard Rhodes goes beyond statistics to describe how individuals become murderers. The biographies of killers often show evidence of a disturbing intergenerational process. Violence begets victimization, begets more violence. Without intervention, this process of violentization is self-perpetuating. But what, then, explains why violence declines? Over the last 20 years, scholars and journalists have tried to pinpoint what causes homicides to rise and fall, with little success, argues historian Randolph Roth in his 2009 book, American Homicide. Researchers have attempted to attribute declining homicides to the removal of lead, a neurotoxin from gasoline, under the theory that it makes exposed children more violent when older, the legalization of abortion, under the theory that unwanted children are more likely to commit crimes, and changes to the death penalty, gun laws, and unemployment. But such efforts miss the wider picture, Roth argues. The reason, he says, is that it is impossible for researchers to hold historical circumstances constant while they study the influence of a single factor. To avoid reductionism, Roth developed the most comprehensive set of homicide data. It covers 400 years of American history. There is only one way to obtain reliable homicide estimates, he writes, and that is to review every scrap of paper on criminal matters in every courthouse, every article in every issue of a number of local newspapers, every entry in the death records, and every local history based on lost sources, local tradition, or oral testimony. Roth believes his method is more reliable than homicide counts based on court records alone, which he argues can be too low by a third or more, especially during wars or revolutions. In his analysis, Roth finds little evidence to support the claim that root causes like poverty and structural racism cause crime rates to rise and fall. African-American crime rates were lower during the 1940s and 1950s, when segregation was legal, poverty more widespread, and discrimination more overt than between 1965 and 1990. Indeed, homicides among African-Americans shot up despite the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's true that homicides rose during the first few years of the Great Depression, but they then declined in most major cities afterward. and crime rates, including for homicide, kept declining even after the 2007 financial crash and resulting recession, the worst since the Great Depression. The underlying drivers of homicide are related to subjective conditions like ideology and politics, says Roth. Social conditions like poverty, oppression, and unemployment do not drive violent acts, as people suffering from these conditions have varied rates of violence throughout history. Homicide is irrational and emotional, not a natural and predetermined response to personal setbacks. Roth views the public's belief in the legitimacy of the system, as well as things like patriotism and fellow feeling, solidarity with one's fellow citizens, as the most important factors when it comes to homicide. Roth finds that the government's monopoly on legitimate violence is fragile, even in an established modern nation-state like the United States, and that the rate of unlawful killing reflects changes to perceived legitimacy. Public trust in government, Roth argues, impacts the prevalence of violence in a way that transcends the immediate impact of short-term economic and social regulations. As such, the New Deal, World War II, and the Cold War may have reduced homicide rates, Roth writes, but the crisis of legitimacy in the 1960s and 1970s, especially in the eyes of African Americans, may have contributed to soaring homicide rates. Homicide rates among unrelated adults in the United States follow closely the proportion of the public who trust their government to do the right thing and believe that most public officials are honest. As trust in government fell in the late 60s and early 70s, homicides increased. When trust in government rose in the 50s and mid-90s, homicides decreased. Roth's research is supported by Steven Pinker's 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. In it, Pinker describes how violence has declined broadly since the dawn of civilization, and specifically in recent American history. Pinker finds downward trends in wars, sectarian violence, anti-woman violence, and child abuse, which he suggests flow from historical trends like industrialization and urbanization. Pinker argues that these historical trends reduced the emotional and practical need for violence, which has given way to the better angels of our personalities, traits like empathy, self-control, and reason. Like the philosopher Thomas Hobbes and sociologist Max Weber, Pinker describes the rise of the modern state, which monopolizes the legitimate use of violence, as a primary cause of radical declines in violence from pre-modern times. California was a national leader in taking a progressive, rehabilitative approach to prisoners starting in the 1940s, building on the humanistic tradition that began in the 18th century. In 1855, guards at the San Quentin prison still flogged inmates and suspended them from the ceiling by their wrists. The governor banned torture 3 years later and began a very gradual move away from punishment toward rehabilitation. In 1947, San Quentin hired a world-class librarian to oversee a great books program for inmates and its world-class book collection. The warden and librarian were optimistic about the prospects of books, sports, and religion to rehabilitate. By 1956, 90% of San Quentin prisoners were reading books from the library, as compared to just 18% of the American people. In 1975, Michel Foucault published Discipline and Punish, which made a similar argument against reformist prisons like San Quentin that he had made against humanistic mental hospitals. Just as so-called reformers caused more harm than good when they treated the mentally ill in hospitals, rather than leave them to wander in the streets, prison reformers only made punishment more insidious and sinister, Foucault felt. The prison reform agenda of more kindness, more respect, more humanity argued Foucault, was a ruse. In reality, what the prison, schools, and other societal institutions did was control individuals without them knowing it. The goal of the state is to neutralize the prisoner's dangerous states of mind and create docile bodies, argued Foucault. Rehabilitation was thus more oppressive than torture because it was more insidious. It made prisoners actually want to rehabilitate themselves. For Foucault, torture and execution had the benefit of being less insidious than the psychotherapeutic approach that replaced it, which established norms of behavior that were powerful precisely because they were taken for granted and accepted without question. Radical thinkers during Foucault's time and today still point to the use of anti-vagrancy laws, the lack of enforcement of laws against corporations and powerful elites, and lower rates of crime in the Western Europe nations that are more socialist than the United States, as evidence of how the criminal justice system protects capitalism, not the people. Equal justice under the law is thus a myth, they argue, because wealthy people can hire skilled attorneys and others to avoid or reduce punishment. Crime is thus a rational response to the high levels of inequality created by capitalism. Foucault and the radical prison movement challenged the legitimacy of the state. The prison offered a powerful metaphor for doing so. Radical prisoners questioned the notion of guilt itself. By his own admission, Foucault's goal was not to make prisons more humane by expanding privileges like better toilets or more visiting time. Instead, he aimed to blur the moral divide between innocence and guilt. Black prisoners were incarcerated because they were black in a racist country, progressives argued. As such, black prisoners incarcerated at San Quentin for rape and robbery convictions were no different from the civil rights activists arrested for sitting at soda counters in North Carolina. That's what America means, prison, said Malcolm X at a 1963 rally. The system in this country cannot produce freedom for an Afro-American, he said in another speech in 1964. It's impossible for a white person to believe in capitalism and not believe in racism. You can't have capitalism without racism. Progressives looked to black radical prison activists for leadership. Prisoners are the revolutionary vanguard of our struggle, declared the Progressive National Lawyers Guild. When prisoners come out, they will lead us in the streets. The Weather Underground, a radical left terrorist group that killed two police officers in 1981, was determined to plug themselves into the black revolution, noted a Times reporter, whether the black revolution wanted them or not. Idealizing radical black prisoners was a way for white people on the radical left to free themselves from guilt they felt for being white, she argued. White skin privilege, she wrote. Rich bitches, spoiled kids, bourgeois liberals. The young radicals of the Vietnam era set out to prove that such phrases did not apply to them. The radical prison movement peaked in 1970 during the murder trial of a prisoner named George Jackson. Jackson promoted violence, writing, "Give the brother a flamethrower. Give him also two comrades in arms, one equipped with an M60 machine gun, the other an anti-tank rocket launcher." Jackson assaulted a bailiff during his trial and had to be subdued. Even so, many progressives maintained that George Jackson was entirely innocent. The Grateful Dead, Pete Seeger, Jane Fonda, and other celebrities raised money for his defense. Foucault co-authored the foreword to the French translation of Jackson's book. Foucault described crime in positive terms, claiming in Discipline and Punish that the existence of crime happily manifests an irrepressibility of human nature. It is necessary to see in it not a weakness or a disease, but rather an energy that is straightening itself out, a striking protestation of human individuality. A radical prison advocacy organization that Foucault supported in France helped trigger more than 24 prison revolts between 1971 and 1973. In 1972, a security guard at a Renault factory shot and killed a worker protesting outside the factory gates. Foucault joined his Maoist comrades in a protest, where they clashed with the police. At the height of the battle, recounted Foucault's biographer, witnesses glimpsed the gleaming skull of the great professor at the Collège de France, absorbing blow after blow from the truncheon of a police officer. For Foucault and others on the radical left, the ends justified the means. When the proletariat takes power, said Foucault, it may exert toward the classes over which it has triumphed a violent, dictatorial, and even bloody power. I can't see what objection one could make to this. The problems created by the new nihilism weren't academic. We had the means of terrorism, recalled another French radical left leader. Some of us were on the way to that kind of action, and you must know that when Foucault was speaking, he was speaking to people who were in the mood of terrorism. In the United States, the radical political rhetoric served as cover for drug dealing and other criminal activities. I came charging out of prison in 1970, expecting to find a Red Army ready for revolutionary war, wrote one black prison radical. What I found was a handful of red criminals with the same worldview I'd had as a pool hall hustler, reinforced with heavy doses of ideology and drugs. So being a revolutionary consisted mainly of snorting coke and putting on the style in Oakland. It was later revealed that the entire California's Prisoners Union, the largest and most heavily funded of the organizations, had become a front for dealing drugs and running prostitutes. Black Panther Party co-founder Huey Newton spent the last 20 years of his life out of prison shaking down liquor stores in a protection racket, running prostitutes, and dealing cocaine to support his addiction. Huey Newton is on drugs, said a San Quentin prisoner in 1989. He became corrupted. When they started off, I don't think they actually thought it would become as big as it became. When it became as big as it became, a lot of money became involved. A few weeks after the interview, somebody fired 3 bullets at point-blank range into Newton's head, apparently after a cocaine deal went bad. The chaos, political radicalism, and rising crime in the late 1960s provoked a desire among all races and both political parties for greater law and order. The California legislature in 1976 passed the Uniform Determinate Sentencing Act, which transformed the sentencing process from one focused on rehabilitation to one focused on punishment. Prior to the new law, there was indeterminate sentencing, which granted judges great latitude in determining sentences. An armed robbery could result in a few years or a life sentence. After a prisoner had served the minimum sentence, a parole board would review their case and decide the remaining sentence length. The Uniform Determinate Sentencing Act replaced arbitrary sentencing with set prison terms mandated by the legislature. Offenders were now given sentences of a standard period of time, with no ability for a parole board to modify punishments. The aim of indeterminate sentencing was to encourage rehabilitation by inmates, but the radical prison movement viewed indeterminate sentencing as discriminatory and paternalistic, while conservatives viewed indeterminate sentencing as too soft on criminals. And so the legislature set long, fixed sentences. Over the next 20 years, it passed nearly 100 laws to increase sentences. The number of prisoners in California quadrupled between 1980 and 1990, adding over 100,000 inmates. Meanwhile, through ballot measures, voters enacted tough-on-crime policies. In the 1980s, California voters approved over $3.6 billion in bonds for prison and jail construction and maintenance. Voters passed Proposition 4, which expanded the denial of bail with 82% of the vote. They also backed Proposition 8, the Victims' Bill of Rights, which granted victims a constitutional right to restitution, increased prison terms for repeat offenders, and reduced the cases where defendants could plea bargain. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, voters, policymakers, judges, and prosecutors pursued steeper charges and longer sentences. Crimes that had before led to little, if any, jail time began to fill prisons and jails. For example, the number of people imprisoned for less serious types of theft rose 565% between 1980 and 1990. In the 1990s, the California legislature and voters enacted other tough-on-crime measures. They included expanded application of the death penalty, the use of hearsay evidence in preliminary hearings in cases of rape, and most notoriously, the Three Strikes You're Out law, which imposed a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years to life for three-time felony offenders. The year 2000 marked the transition from tough-on-crime policies to softer policies. Voters in 2000 passed Proposition 21, which I fought and failed to defeat, which expanded the circumstances whereby juveniles can be tried as adults. But California voters also passed a ballot initiative, Proposition 36, created by Ethan Nadelman and funded by George Soros, which permitted offenders convicted for the first or second time for a nonviolent low-level drug possession offense to receive probation and community-based drug treatment instead of jail or prison. It was the first of a series of measures passed over the next two decades that gradually reduced penalties for using and then for dealing hard drugs.